Laystow. She shared the house with her unmarried youngest son, Frederick, and her widowed daughter, Anne. She also owned several properties in Limehouse that had been left to her by her husband upon his death in 1882. Aunt Emily asked her if she knew the whereabouts of her other daughter-in-law, Emily, whom they had lost. The older Mrs. Coombe said that she had no idea where she was. Emily assured her that they would find the missing woman that day. Mary Ann Burridge sent a telegram to Mary Macy, the older sister of Robert and Natty's mother, and that same morning received in reply a telegram from Liverpool stating that Emily was not there. Robert and Natty's uncle Nathaniel tried the Cave Road house himself, then went to look for the boys in the recreation ground. He could not find them. At 1:20 p.m., Aunt Emily and Mary Jane Burridge banged again at the door of 35 Cave Road. Mrs. Burridge had brought along her youngest son, James, a boy of Robert's age. At first there was no reply, but at their second knock, Robert opened the door. Emily pushed past him, followed by the Burridges, and marched through to the back of the house. Robert, Natty, and Fox had been playing cards. Natty scrambled them up when he saw his aunt. He rose to his feet, but Fox stayed in his chair, smoking a pipe. A strong smell of tobacco permeated the room. Emily asked Robert where his ma was. "She is with Mrs. Cooper," Robert said. "I will take you to see her." "No," said Emily. "Your ma is in this house, and I won't go away until our policeman comes."
"All right," said Robert.
On hearing his aunt's warning, Natty climbed out of the back parlour window and ran for the market gardens beyond the yard. Emily asked Robert whether she could go into his mother's room.
"No," he said. "It is locked."
She asked him where the key was, and he replied that he did not know.
"All right," she said. "I will burst open the door."
Mrs. Burridge said to Robert, "Your mother is lying dead in that room upstairs."
"No, she isn't, Mrs. Burridge," said Robert. "She's in Liverpool."
"I don't believe it," said Mrs. Burridge. She and Aunt Emily went upstairs, but when they tried to force the door, found that it would not give. They sent someone to fetch a spare key from the landlady. The key was brought, and Aunt Emily opened the door to the bedroom. There she saw the form of a woman, lying on the bed, the face covered by a sheet and a pillow. Overcome by the smell of rotting flesh, she drew back and sent Mary Jane Burridge and her son to find a policeman. Now that the bedroom door was open, the stench spread swiftly through the house. At 1:30 p.m., Harriet Hayward of 39 Cave Road approached the front door and bent to peer through the frosted glass panels to see if she could spy the boys in the passage. She was startled by the smell issuing from the letterbox. The day was becoming intensely hot. A black cloud of blowflies hovered at the upstairs windows. Mrs. Hayward hurried away to fetch Mrs. Robertson from number 37. "Come and have a smell," she urged her. The Burridges found Constable Robert Twort in Greengate Street, a block away from Cave Road. A single man of 24, Twort lived as well as worked at the Barking Road Police Depot. He was dressed in a high-collared, dark navy woollen tunic with his number on the collar, 686K, high-waisted fishtail trousers and a domed helmet. He carried a truncheon, a pen and notebook, and a whistle. Twort went straight to the house with the Burridges. Aunt Emily showed him upstairs. In the front bedroom, P.C. Twort turned down the sheet and lifted the pillow to reveal a woman's body, severely decomposed and swarming with maggots. He saw a knife on the bed and a truncheon on the floor. He sent word to the police station asking for an inspector and the divisional surgeon to come to the house at once. Aunt Emily approached the bed and looked at her sister-in-law's body, but the face was so disfigured that she could not recognize her. She returned to the back parlour, where Robert was standing by the window. Fox was sitting on a chair between the door and the dresser.
"You are a bad, wicked boy," she told Robert. "You knew your ma was dead in the room, and you ought to have told me." "Auntie," he replied, "come to me and I will tell you the truth and tell you all about it." His aunt went towards him. "Ma gave Natty a hiding on Saturday for stealing some food," said Robert, "and she said, 'I will give you one too.' Natty said, 'I will stab her.' 'No, I can't do it, Bob, but will you do it? When I cough twice, you do it.' 'I did do it.'"
Emily asked him if his mother was awake at the time.
"Yes," he said. "She was lying with her hand over her face." "Did your ma cry?"
"She did not cry nor speak.
I covered her up and afterwards went away to Lord's cricket ground."
Emily asked at what time he had killed his mother.
"About 3:45 on the Monday morning," said Robert, "a week ago. I slept with Ma that night, and I kicked about a great deal, and she punched me. Natty was in his room. I did it by myself."
She asked how he had killed her.
"I got out of bed and I stabbed her," said Robert. "Natty was in the back room and coughed twice, and that was when I done it, when Natty coughed. I did it with a knife, and it is on the bed."
Mrs. Hayward, of 39 Cave Road, had by now come in to number 35, taken a quick look at the corpse on the bed upstairs, and then joined the party in the back parlour. She addressed John Fox.
"What, you, John?" Mrs. Hayward said. "You have been here all this time. Didn't you know what was going on?"
"No, missus," he replied. "I know nothing about it. The boys fetched me from the ship."
Robert said,
"No, Mrs. Hayward, John knows nothing about it. I did it."
"You bad boy," said Harriet Hayward.
Aunt Emily asked him the whereabouts of his father's gold watch.
"I have pawned it," said Robert. "I got Fox to do it. I'll give you the ticket."
He took the pawn tickets from a bookshelf on the parlour wall and was about to hand them to her when Tort came into the room. On discovering a murder, a policeman was meant to keep close watch on the body until relieved by another officer, but Tort had found the smell so overpowering that he had remained upstairs for only 5 minutes. Aunt Emily told the constable that her nephew had been making a confession to her. Tort cautioned Robert, and then asked him to repeat what he had told his aunt. As Robert spoke, Tort took notes in his book.
"I did it," Robert began. "My brother Natty got a hiding for stealing some food, and Ma was going to give me one. So Natty said that he would stab her, but as he could not do it himself, he asked me to do it. He said, 'When I cough twice, you do it.' He coughed twice, and I did it. I am sorry that I did it. I did it with a knife, which I left on the bed. I covered her up and left her."
Tort asked where Natty was.
"I think he has gone to Woolwich," said Robert, "as we were going there this afternoon."
North Woolwich, with its public pleasure gardens, was next to the Victoria and Albert docks. South Woolwich was across the Thames, a short ride on a free ferry. Tort turned to John Fox and asked what he was doing there. Fox said that he had been there since Wednesday. He added,
"I do not know nothing what has taken place."
At 2 o'clock, Police Sergeant Henry Botch, a married man of 30, also from the Barking Road station, knocked at the door of 35 Cave Road. Mrs. Hayward let him in as she left the house. Aunt Emily and Tort met him in the passage and took him through to the back parlour. Robert repeated his confession to the sergeant.
"My brother Natty said he would kill Mother, as she had given him a hiding for stealing food. He then asked me to do it. Natty then said, 'When I cough twice, you stab Mother with the knife,' which I did. We then went to a cricket match at Lord's and have slept in the house ever since."
Robert gave Bulch 4 pawnbroker's duplicates, those for the watches and the mandolin, and another for an item that his mother had pawned before her death.
"I took the property," Robert told him, "and gave it to Fox to pledge."
"Yes," Fox said, "Robert gave it to me and I pawned it."
Tort told Fox that he must accompany him to the station. He led him away. Bulch stayed in the house with Robert until the police surgeon, Alfred Kennedy, showed up at about 3 o'clock. When Dr. Kennedy went upstairs to examine the body,
Walsh took Robert to the police station at 386 Barking Road. Meanwhile, other constables were hunting for Natty. At 5 o'clock, he was found on the lane leading to the Plaistow Marshes, off the Barking Road, and only minutes from his home.
P.C. George Hardy asked him, "Is your name Coombs?"
"Yes," said Natty.
"I didn't kill my mother. It was my brother who did it when I was in bed."
"You will have to come with me to the station," said Hardy.
At the police station, Detective Inspector George Mellish charged Robert Allen Coombs and Nathaniel George Coombs with murder, and John Fox with being an accessory after the fact. Fox was very nervous, jerking his head, looking round him wildly. The boys were calm and said nothing. They were all locked in cells. Mellish, 45, was a member of Scotland Yard's Criminal Investigation Department and had worked for 15 years for the K Division, which covered West Ham and Limehouse. He lived north of Plaistow with his wife and 8 children. At 5:15 p.m. he left the police station with Inspector George Gilbert of the Barking Road branch to survey the crime scene at 35 Cave Road. The inspectors examined the corpse of Emily Harrison Coombs. Her body was on the left-hand side of the bed and inclined slightly to the left. She was dressed in a chemise, a petticoat, drawers and stockings. On the night of her death she had gone to bed in her underwear rather than a nightdress. There were 2 gaping wounds near her heart, each about 1.5 inches deep. These were infested by maggots, and maggots had also destroyed her thighs, calves and genitals, her eyes and her nose. Her chemise and bedclothes were stained with dried blood. A blood-soaked diaper, a cloth of fine white fabric with a raised diamond pattern, was lying on the left-hand side of the bed, near the washstand. The maggots had wriggled across the bedclothes and dropped onto the floor. The police discovered a bloodied wedding ring and 2 purses on the bed. The leather purse was empty. The white purse, a seaside souvenir constructed from 2 shells joined by a hinge, contained 4 threepenny pieces and 2 foreign coins. Elsewhere in the bedroom were an empty jewel case and a quantity of loose jewellery, a gold bracelet, a brooch, shirt studs, 2 more wedding rings, a pair of silver earrings. The chest of drawers had been ransacked and its contents strewn on the floor. On top of the chest was a pawnbroker's ticket and a locked cash box with a smashed base. In the back parlour downstairs, the police found Robert's collection of penny dreadfuls, which they gathered up as evidence. They also discovered the key to Emily Coombs's bedroom, tucked under a sofa cushion, and the torn-off date of the medical certificate that Robert had shown John Hewson. From the scullery, they took a boy's flannelette nightshirt, which had been hanging on a line over the fireplace, as well as 2 full-size blue serge jackets, a pair of serge trousers, and a waistcoat. On a table, they found 3 unsent letters on a blotting pad, 2 by Robert, to his father and to the Evening News, and 1 by his mother, written to her husband on the day before she died. They found the Coombs's rent book, paid up to 8 July, but missing the 15 July payment, as well as an IOU for £5 and a post office savings book with a balance of £35. Robert's father had left £10 in cash to tide the family over during his 5 to 6 week absence, of which the boys had spent about £7 in 10 days. There was a knife on the bed in the front bedroom, as Robert had said. Mellish and Gilbert saw the truncheon on the bedroom floor, as well as an empty revolver in the front parlour and a new hatchet in the back bedroom. They thought that the truncheon might have been kept as protection against intruders, or as a stick to pound washing. The presence of the gun was unexplained. Perhaps it was a souvenir brought back from America by Robert Natty's father, like the silver watch and the mockingbird. The hatchet was probably used to chop wood. The police inspectors thought that this one might also have hacked open the cash box in the bedroom. Inspectors Mellish and Gilbert summoned an undertaker to transfer Emily Coombs's corpse to a coffin shell and transport it to the public mortuary on the Barking Road.
Part 2. The City of the Damned. Chapter 4. The Machine and the Abyss. Robert, Natty and John Fox stayed overnight in the Barking Road police cells, and on Thursday morning were taken to the Magistrates' Court in Stratford for a preliminary hearing. The courthouse in West Ham Lane had been built 11 years earlier to designs by the architect also responsible for the Stratford Town Hall, which was next door, and the Barking Road Public Hall and Library. It was a three-storey yellow brick building, Italianate in style, and adorned with Portland stone carvings of the royal arms. There was no separate court for young defendants. Though both Robert and Natty were children, defined by the Children's Act of 1889 as a boy under 14 or a girl under 16, they were considered criminally responsible if they could tell right from wrong and would be tried in the same way as adults. A huge crowd had assembled outside the courthouse. The Sun, a liberal halfpenny paper, observed that the excitement generated by the recent election in West Ham had given place to an excitement of a very different kind. The court opened when the district's stipendiary magistrate, Ernest Baggerley, reached Stratford from his home in Kensington, an affluent neighbourhood near the centre of London. "West Ham Police Court depends for its opening on whether Mr. Baggerley has caught his train or not," said the radical evening paper The Star. "Today it was 11:30 before he arrived to deal with public business." The police cleared him a pass through the crowd. Baggerley had accepted the position of salaried magistrate for West Ham 8 years earlier, after surrendering his seat as Conservative MP for Brixton, South London. He was a slender, mustachioed man of 45, neatly turned out, who leant forward pertly in his seat as he heard the cases brought before him. He was sometimes dismissive of witnesses. In Canning Town Police Court that week, he had listened to two women testify against a neighbour accused of having neglected and beaten three of his children. One woman told the court that the children had come to her starving, saying that their father was giving them no food. The other said that she had heard the father knocking them against the wall. Baggerley was impatient with their testimony. "Let us have the doctor's evidence," he suggested. "These women do so exaggerate." The doctor confirmed that he had treated members of the defendant's family for bruises and black eyes. An engine driver then testified to having heard the children screaming and begging for mercy. Even after this, Baggerley declined to find against the accused. Despite the passage of the Children's Act, which made it possible to prosecute a parent for neglect or cruelty, and even to remove a child from his or her family, many magistrates were reluctant to intervene in such matters. Corporal punishment was commonplace, and the popular presumption remained that a parent's authority over a child was close to sacrosanct. Fox, Natty and Robert were led into the courtroom together. Fox slouched towards the dock, in Mr. Coombs's grey suit, which looked several sizes too large for him. Robert walked in coolly and stood upright in white flannel trousers, brown boots, and a blue tennis jacket braided with gold. Natty also held himself erect, but was so small that he could barely see over the dock's top rail. He wore knickerbockers and a light tweed jacket. Both boys stood with their hands clasped behind their backs, as they had been taught to do at school. Their father was not present. The older Robert Coombs was halfway across the Atlantic, unaware that his wife was dead, and his sons were in court for her murder. The law barred defendants from testifying, but since Fox, Robert and Natty had no legal representation, they were entitled to question the witnesses that Baggerley called. The first was Alfred Kennedy, 48, the police surgeon, who had visited Cave Road on Wednesday. He had run a practice since the 1870s in Balham Street, and he served as surgeon for the K Division of the Metropolitan Police. After the doctor's evidence about the condition of the corpse, Baggerley turned to Fox and asked, "Fox, do you wish to ask the witness any questions?" Fox stammered softly, "All I know is..." and tailed off. "Well," said Baggerley, "you need not make a statement. Nothing is said about you by the witness. The same applies to you boys. The witness simply refers to what he found."
Alfred Kennedy then left the courtroom for the mortuary, where he was due to conduct the post-mortem on Emily Coombs's body. Aunt Emily gave her evidence. She said that she had last visited her sister-in-law on Saturday, 6 July, and had arranged to see her again 2 days later. On Monday, she said, she knocked several times at the door of 35 Cave Road, but received no reply. This was the first day on which Robert and Natty were at Lord's. She related how she had tried the house again the following Monday, when Fox opened the door to her, and how she finally forced her way in on Wednesday with Mary Jane Burrage and discovered the crime. When she described how Robert had confessed to her, she broke down in tears and she sobbed through the rest of her testimony. Bagley asked Fox, "Do you wish to ask any questions, Fox?"
"You found me in the parlour," Fox said to her.
"Yes," said Bagley, "she says so."
"That was the only place I was," said Fox.
Aunt Emily was led weeping from the court. James Robertson took the witness stand and told the court that he had changed a sovereign for Robert on Monday, 8 July, and that his wife had then paid the rent for 35 Cave Road. P.C. Tort gave evidence about the arrest of the boys. Fox asked him,
"Did I tell you I was sleeping in the parlour?"
"Yes," said Tort.
"Did I say it was done 2.5 days before I came there?"
"No," replied Tort, "you said nothing about it." Fox did not get a chance to question P.S. Bulge, as the sergeant fainted in the witness box while describing his visit to Cave Road on Wednesday. He was carried out of the court. Two or three women in the public gallery had already collapsed during the hearing and been removed from the room. At the conclusion of the evidence, Detective Inspector Mellish asked for the boys and Fox to be remanded in jail while the investigation continued. He suggested that Robert be examined by the prison's medical officer. Bagley said he hardly knew what to do with boys of their age. He had never sent lads so young to prison, but he could see no alternative. He remanded them and Fox to Holloway Jail. As such a big crowd had assembled outside the courthouse, Bagley asked the police to avoid walking Fox and the brothers through the streets in handcuffs, but instead to find a cab to take them to the railway station. Mellish said that he would arrange a conveyance. The boys were both seen laughing as the police hustled them into a horse-drawn cab in West Ham Lane. The Stratford Express approved of how Ernest Bagley had protected the boys from being paraded through the district on their way to the station. The magistrate had saved them from becoming a piece of street theatre, shielding them from the vulgar gaze, the vulgar derision or, still more stinging, vulgar sympathy of the public. At 4:30 that afternoon, a street vendor in Northern Road, Plaistow, was selling copies of the Evening News, the right-wing halfpenny paper in which Robert had planned to advertise for a loan. The edition of Thursday, 18 July, carried reports that the Tories had routed the Liberals and Radicals throughout the metropolis in the early stages of the general election. "Bravo, London," the headline ran, "a glorious victory." The vendor was calling out to passers-by that the issue contained reports of the Coombs hearing. A disgruntled customer notified a passing police constable from the Barking Road station that he had found no mention of the case in his copy of the paper. The constable warned the newspaper salesman to stop defrauding the public, at which the vendor punched the policeman in the eye, knocking him down, and then kicked him repeatedly as he lay on the ground. Holloway Jail, which lay 7 miles west of Stratford, was the city's main remand prison, and the largest such institution in the country. An average of 70 men and boys were admitted each day to be held within its walls until called for trial. The jail was constructed in the 1850s on the panopticon principle, with a hub radiating out to 6 wings. From the entrance on Parkhurst Road, it looked like a castle, its central arched gateway flanked by crenellated turrets and statues of stone griffins clutching leg irons and keys. "May God preserve the City of London," read the foundation stone in the prison wall, "and make this place a terror to evil-doers." Robert was familiar with stories of crime and punishment. As well as having seen James Canham Reed appear before the magistrates in Southend, he had read many penny dreadfuls that featured Cockney villains. One of the novelettes found in Cave Road was Joe Phoenix's Unknown, or Crushing the Crook Combination, in which East End criminals dream up dodges to acquire a tidy bit of swag. They then cover their tracks, lie low, and if unlucky enough to be caught by bobbies or peelers, are put in bracelets and brought before the beak. They will try to brazen the thing out, but may end up doing time in stone jug. On no account will they peach or split on their pals. The police rang the bell at the Holloway entrance to gain admission. A grate opened in the heavy oak door, an eye peered out, and the iron bolts were drawn back to admit the new prisoners. They were directed to the left, where the 350 men being held on remand were housed in five wings, supervised by 40 warders. A single wing to the right accommodated 65 female convicts. New arrivals were taken across a courtyard to the inner entrance of the prison and into a long passage with reception cells on either side. They waited until summoned by a warder, who informed them of the prison's rules, then told them to strip to the waist in order to be weighed and measured. A warder cropped the prisoner's hair, sent them to bathe, bundled up and stored their clothes, and issued them with dark grey uniforms. Robert, Natty and John Fox were led through the central hall, beneath a glass roof in a massive iron frame, to individual cells in the three-storey blocks. Each cell measured 13 by 7 foot, and was 9 foot high, with an asphalt floor, whitewashed walls, and a small window. Pinned to one wall were the prison regulations, a copy of the prison timetable, and a card detailing the prisoner's name, number, and age. The cells also contained hymn books and copies of the prayer book and the Bible. The boys and John Fox took to their pallet beds for the night. The inquest into Emily Harrison Coombs's death opened the next day, Friday, 19 July, at the Liverpool Arms, a large public house at the southern end of the Barking Road. The coroner was Charles Carne Lewis, 62, who had succeeded his father as coroner for Essex in 1882. The most notorious death he had investigated to date was that of Florence Dennis, the young woman who had been murdered by John Canham Reed in Southend the previous summer. His most recent case, which had concluded the day before the Emily Coombs inquest, was an inquiry into a series of deaths at the East Ham sewage works. On 1 July, an employee at the sewage pumping station had become dizzy with fumes as he climbed down a ladder into a well. He lost his balance and fell in. One of his workmates descended the ladder to try to help, but collapsed and fell into the pit as the sewer gases overtook him. Three more men attempted rescues, and everyone fainted and fell. All five drowned in the filth at the bottom of the well. Their deaths were attributed, in part, to the putrid conditions created by the drought. Lewis took his place at the head of a large dining table in a bright square room in the Liverpool Arms. The place was furnished with bronze urns and large leafed plants, which were reflected in a long gilt-framed mirror on the mantelpiece. The walls were covered with rich paper and hung with oil paintings. Next to Lewis sat his clerk, surrounded by parchments and legal volumes, passages of which were marked off with strips of blue paper. The jury of 12 men sat round the table. Their foreman was Joseph Horlock, a 49-year-old master builder who lived opposite the pub. Detective Inspector Mellish and Inspector Gilbert were present on behalf of the police. The coroner's inquest and the magistrate's hearing were to run concurrently. The chief task of the coroner's court was to establish how Emily Coombs had died, and that of the magistrate's court to decide who, if anyone, should be charged with causing her death. Yet there was room for overlap and even conflict in their deliberations. If a coroner's jury found that the cause of death was murder, they could name suspects and order their arrest.
A crowd of about 500 people had assembled in the street outside, and when a closed cab drew up outside the pub just after 11 o'clock, they made a rush at its doors. The police managed to hold back the mob, allowing John Fox and two Holloway warders to enter the Liverpool Arms. Robert and Natty had been spared the ordeal of attending the inquest because of their youth. Fox was given a seat in the coroner's court, where he sat for a few moments, his head leaning against the wall, before Lewis announced that he did not intend to examine him and did not consider it advisable that he be present. A member of the jury asked whether Fox should at least be allowed to hear the evidence, and Lewis replied that this was exactly what he did not want. The warders took Fox away. Several hundred people chased the cab that carried him off. Lewis swore in the jury and called Alfred Kennedy, who had now completed the post-mortem on Emily Coombs's body. "The whole of the brain had been consumed by vermin," Dr. Kennedy told the coroner and jury, "and the right lung was nearly destroyed by maggots. Through the base of the heart, which was partly eaten away, there was a clear stab, and one also through the extreme right side. There was a notch on the spine corresponding with this wound." The doctor said that Emily Coombs's bedding and underclothes had been stained with dry blood, which indicated that she had been alive when she was stabbed. "There is no doubt," he said, "that death was instantaneous." The jurors were invited to leave the pub for the mortuary on the other side of the Barking Road. They had to make their way through a crowd to enter the building. Emily Coombs's body was in a double coffin, designed to contain the smell of a corpse and to slow its decomposition. The internal shell which held the body was usually filled with melted pitch and sealed shut. The upper part of the shell was fitted with plate glass so that the mourners, or in this case jurors, could see the face of the dead person. Emily Coombs's features had been mutilated by maggots. The jurors completed their inspection as quickly as they could. When the coroner and jury returned to the pub, Lewis called Robert and Natty's Aunt Emily to give evidence. She was dressed in deep mourning, with a broad-brimmed black hat sitting horizontally on her high bun of dark hair. Her voice broke as she described the offensive smell that assailed her as she entered 35 Cave Road on Wednesday, to find her nephews playing cards and Fox puffing on his pipe. She repeated Robert's confession to her, quoting him as saying, "I kicked about and Ma pushed me. I then got out of bed and stabbed her." The coroner pointed out that Robert's account of the murder was confusing. "I don't quite see," said Lewis, "how this part of the story tallies with the other part, in which he said the blow was to be struck after Nathaniel's signal from an adjoining room. It will probably, however, be cleared up later." The foreman of the jury asked Aunt Emily if she had not thought it strange that her sister-in-law seemed to have vanished. "All through I thought it was strange," said Emily, "but Mrs. Coombs had some funny ways. She would not write for weeks at times." After hearing two further witnesses, Lewis adjourned the inquest. It would reconvene in 10 days on 29 July. Now that the post-mortem and the viewing of Emily Coombs's corpse were complete, arrangements were quickly made to inter the body. Emily had paid a couple of pence a week to a burial insurance scheme, as was common practice among working-class people who wished to spare their families the financial burden of an unexpected death. The undertaker, Richard Wortley of 269 Barking Road, was instructed to keep the costs of her funeral low so that her husband could retain some of the payout. In the morning of Saturday, 20 July, Wortley transferred Emily Coombs's body to a plain wooden coffin, screwed down the lid, and conveyed it by hearse and carriage to the Tower Hamlets and East London Cemetery, 3 miles west. Bow Cemetery, as it was known locally, had since its establishment in 1841 been the chief burial ground for the poor of East London. A third-class interment here cost about 15 shillings. By 1895, the cemetery contained more than 250,000 bodies, most of them in shared public graves,
and had become neglected and overgrown. Many of the headstones had fallen down and were half covered by weeds and grass. At 1 p.m., Emily's body was lowered into a long trench of public graves in a section of the cemetery adjacent to Lockhart Street, where Robert and Natty's grandmother, Mary Coombs, lived. Since the police had kept the details of the funeral a secret, only 2 or 3 members of the family were present. Robert and Natty were not invited to attend. The mourners cast earth onto the coffin, and the priest, a Reverend Yates, stood over the grave and read the words of committal. That day, 4 policemen, led by Inspector Gilbert and Detective Sergeant Don, went to 35 Cave Road to burn the filthy bedding from the front bedroom. Despite the disinfectants with which the room had been doused 3 days earlier, both Gilbert and Don reported that the stench was almost unbearable. After their visit, they left a constable at the gate to make sure that sightseers were kept out. Ever since the discovery of Emily Coombs's body, local men and women had been visiting Cave Road to see the house and to discuss the case with whoever was passing. West Ham was so full of people, and the people so avid for entertainment, that spontaneous gatherings were commonplace. A few weeks earlier, a 14-year-old boy had climbed a tree in the grove near Stratford Broadway and started dropping twigs and bits of bark onto the hats of people walking below. He refused to budge when the police ordered him down, and it was reported that nearly 3,000 people turned up to watch the constables remove him from the tree with the aid of a fire ladder. The inhabitants of West Ham looked for their drama, whether comedy or tragedy, in the streets. The penny paper, Lloyd's Weekly, which had a circulation of more than 750,000, sent an artist and a reporter to Cave Road. The artist sketched the house, the arched doorway and bay window on the ground floor, the 2 open windows of Emily Coombs's bedroom above, the low fence and the metal gate bounding the front yard. The journalist interviewed the locals who had gathered nearby. He was told that Robert and Natty had a very bad reputation, and that their mother had been too lenient with them, always allowing them to have their own way. Robert was said to have been a constant source of trouble to the school officials. He had frequently been late and had often played truant. 3 years earlier, the reporter heard, the brothers had run away to Liverpool to visit an aunt, using money stolen from their mother's cash box. The police had been informed, but when the boys were found, their mother interceded and managed to hush up the affair. Some of the neighbours' stories exaggerated the facts. Over the past 10 days, the Lloyd's man was told, Robert and Natty had led a fast life in the West End of London, riding about in cabs and watching shows at the theatre. One neighbour said that Robert was a talented mandolin player. This love of music, the Lloyd's reporter observed, is not infrequent among the bad folk of criminal history. Several other journalists turned up to interview the bystanders. The Forest Gate Gazette was informed that Robert had been treating his friends to lavish quantities of ginger beer and ice cream in the days after his mother's death. The News of the World heard that Fox was a semi-lunatic and a religious fanatic. The paper ran its report under the headline, Horror on Horror's Head, the most dreadful murder of the century. 2 Plaistow boys slay their mother and play cards beneath the corpse with a maniac. The West Ham Herald was told, also incorrectly, that Natty had continued to go to school after the killing and had been found once or twice with tears streaming down his cheeks. When his playmates asked him what was wrong, he said, I am crying about mother. Natty was said to have told a friend that he wanted to kill himself. According to this paper, Aunt Emily arrived at 3:30 p.m. on 17 July to find Natty alone in the house sobbing, and he informed her that his mother was in her bedroom. Several of the stories relayed by the newspapermen depicted Natty as vulnerable, powerless, distraught, and Robert as the insouciant mastermind who took pleasure in the plunder of his mother's house. These accounts suggested that one boy, at least, had traces of conscience, even if the other was thoroughly bad.
an editorial in Saturday's edition of the Stratford Express, which had the highest circulation of any West Ham paper, described the murder at Plaistow as "the most horrible, the most awful and revolting crime that we have ever been called upon to record. In the wildest dreams of fiction, nothing has ever been depicted which equals in loathsomeness this story of sons playing at cards in a room which the dead body of their murdered mother filled with the stench of corruption." "The Plaistow Horror," it said, "is a story which must depress all who are longing for the improvement of mankind. It will pain public feeling to an extent which has rarely been equalled. It seems to plunge us back at once into the Dark Ages."
The newspaper was alluding to the popular belief that the human race was in decline. "We stand now in the midst of a severe mental epidemic, a sort of black death of degeneration and hysteria," wrote the Hungarian author Max Nordau in Degeneration, a work of 1892, published in English early in 1895. As evidence, Nordau pointed to the prevalence of madness and criminality among the poor, as well as the publication of decadent literature by such artists as Henrik Ibsen and Oscar Wilde. "The day is over," he warned. "The night draws on." Nordau's tract was much discussed in the British press. Its feverish tone was mocked in some quarters, and its apocalyptic ideas treated with scepticism by many, but the pessimistic tone was commonplace. "A wave of unrest is passing over the world," warned the British author Hugh E. M. Stutfield in the summer of 1895. "Revolt is the order of the day. Ours may be an age of progress, but it is progress which, if left unchecked, will land us in the hospital or the lunatic asylum." Darwin's theory of evolution was widely accepted by the end of the 19th century, but with it had come the possibility that the human organism could develop backwards as well as forwards. The atrophy of the species was attributed to the speed and pressure of modern life. Telegrams, railways, big business, a craving for instant pleasure, and to an increasingly urban industrial environment. "The close confines and foul air of our cities are shortening the life of the individual and raising up a puny and ill-developed race," wrote James Cantley in Degeneration Amongst Londoners. "It is beyond prophecy to guess even what the rising generation will grow into, what this empire will become after they have got charge of it." In The Time Machine, published in 1895, H.G. Wells imagined a future in which the workers had degenerated into pale, ape-like Morlocks, living in darkness underground, toiling on machines to make goods for the frail, decaying Eloi on the Earth's surface. The far east of London was the ultimate industrial wilderness. Where the German visitor to Plaistow in 1886 had seen brass bands and fat-cheeked children, most journalists and novelists saw only pinched, degraded lives. An illustrated London news reporter described West Ham's lines of "little, hideous, slate-roofed houses of stucco and pale brick. Row follows row, all dreary, all mean." The French novelist Émile Zola said that he had never seen such miles of soulless brick and mortar. The English writer Ford Madox Hoefer described West Ham as a featureless fog, a vast cloud beneath a cloud as vast, while Walter Besant saw it as a sea of the working class, its history as mostly a blank, making no more mark than the breezes of yesterday have made on the waves and waters of the ocean. "It was a city without a centre," said Besant, "a city without art or literature, but filled with the appliances of science." To a passing visitor, he wrote, "it seemed a joyless region, the city of dreadful monotony, a vast city without a heart." Many onlookers detected an atavistic horror beneath the blank uniformity of East London. "As there is a darkest Africa, is there not also a darkest England?" asked William Booth, the Methodist preacher who founded the Salvation Army.
The stony streets of London, if they could but speak, would tell of tragedies as awful, of ruin as complete, of ravishments as horrible, as if we were in Central Africa. Only the ghastly devastation is covered corpse-like with the artificialities and hypocrisies of modern civilization.
The technologically advanced environment seemed, perversely, to be propelling people back to their bestial origins, the factories and machines turning out morons and monsters. The landscape was both futuristic and primeval.
"Every resident of the district," wrote Heffer, "was conscious of having, as it were, at his back, the very green and very black stretches of the Essex marshes." The American novelist Jack London characterized East Londoners as a people of the machine and the abyss.
In his novel The Nether World, George Gissing described a railway journey east out of the city. From the train carriage, the passengers see the pest-stricken suburbs sweltering in sunshine that served only to reveal the intimacies of abomination. The train passes above streets swarming with a nameless populace, stops at stations which it crushes the heart to think should be the destination of any mortal. At last the train leaves the city of the damned, carrying its passengers beyond the utmost limits of dread.
Chapter 5. A Kiss Goodbye. On the Thursday after the arrest of the Coombs boys and John Fox, the Star newspaper managed to secure an interview with Mary Jane Burridge, who had been present at the discovery of Emily Coombs's body. Mrs. Burridge told the reporter that she had been an intimate friend of the murdered woman, whom she used to see almost every day. "Emily," she said, "was a bright, happy person, an exemplary wife and mother, and a careful housewife. As for Robert and Natty, no boys were ever better brought up, but they were dark, sullen lads, with never a smile for anybody. They were deceitful and dishonest in small things," she said, "and when they told her that their mother had gone to Liverpool for a funeral, she had known instantly that it was all lies. I knew she would never go away without telling me, and I knew she would not leave the boys in the house alone. The neighbours laughed and sneered at me when I first said she was dead," said Mrs. Burridge, "but now they see."
Mary Jane Burridge was exhausted by her ordeal, said the Star. She recalled the horror of finding the corpse, "the thing on the bed," as she described her friend's body. "The smell," she exclaimed, reeling at the memory. "The flies were everywhere." On the right side of Emily's face, she said, that she had seen a clot of blood, apparently from a wound to the temple, and afterwards had watched the doctor remove the clot to reveal a writhing cluster of maggots. Mrs. Burridge reported that the boy's grandmother in Bow was nearly mad with shock. The Star correspondent asked if Fox had rented a room in the house.
"No," she said. "Old John was not a lodger. Mrs. Coombs never had any lodgers. She was not that kind of woman."
Mrs. Burridge was at pains to impress on the reporter that both she and her friend were respectable housewives who did not need to bring in extra cash. Mrs. Burridge claimed that Fox had never been to the house in Emily Coombs's lifetime, unless perhaps to do a job for Mr. Coombs. In this, as in other matters, she expressed with certainty things that she did not know for sure. Family, friends, and neighbours were to testify that John Fox had been a frequent visitor to Cave Road before the murder, whether to chop wood for Emily Coombs or to look after the boys. He had even helped the family to move into the house in 1892. Mrs. Burridge went on to assert that Fox was 36, he was 45, and to cast doubt on his honesty, saying that he was adept at faking simple-mindedness or playing silly. The reporter asked her to comment on certain rumours about the boys and their mother.
"It is not true that they were kept without pocket money," she replied, "and it is a lie to say that Mrs. Coombs drank, as great a lie as ever was told. You can see that by her beautiful house."
For Mrs. Burridge, the condition of the house was proof of her friend's virtue and sobriety. She told the reporter that 35 Cave Road was prettily furnished and well kept,
replete with lovely and interesting objects, some of them valuable, which Mr. Coombs had brought back from his travels. Mrs. Burrage said that she dreaded to think how he would take the news. Throughout the murder and the arrests, through the first hearings before the magistrate and the coroner, Robert and Natty's father had been sailing to New York on the SS France, oblivious to the catastrophe that had befallen his family in Plaistow. Robert Coombs Sr. was a slight man of 51, with a receding chin, sandy sideburns, and a moustache. The eldest son of a prosperous potato merchant and greengrocer, he was born in 1844 in Southwark, on the south bank of the Thames, but his family moved north of the river to Limehouse when he was a boy. He was a butcher by the age of 15, and by 25, a master pork butcher in Notting Hill, West London, employing 3 men and 3 boys, including his younger brother Frederick. In 1873, though, he was declared bankrupt. Thanks to an act of 1869, bankrupts were no longer automatically imprisoned. Coombs instead had his assets seized and distributed among his creditors. Having lost his business, his home, and its contents, he went north to Liverpool and became a ship steward for the National Steamship Company Limited, a fleet established in 1863 to ferry emigrants across the Atlantic. It was in Liverpool that he met Emily Allen, whose father was a captain on emigrant ships to Australia. Emily was born in the town of Karachi, then part of India, and bore the middle name Harrison, in honour of a captain who had rescued her pregnant mother from a shipwreck on the River Indus. She was dark and attractive, with thick eyebrows and a firm jaw. The two were married in 1878. Robert Coombs was 33, though he gave his age as 26 on the marriage certificate, and Emily was 20. They were said to be a loving couple. After the opening of the Royal Albert Dock in 1880, they moved from Liverpool to East London, where much of the National Line's business was being transferred, and where he briefly ran his father's greengrocery business. Robert, their first son, was born in Mile End, Old Town, on 6 January 1882, and Nathaniel in Limehouse on 20 February 1883. The family spent a year in Liverpool from 1890, and on their return to London rented a house in Lydon Road, Plaistow, before moving half a mile northeast in 1892 to Cave Road. The people of East London were in constant flux, observed the social reformer Charles Booth. They shift from one part of it to another, like fish in a river. Coombe served chiefly on the National Line vessels England and France, both of them iron-hulled steamships built in the 1860s with single funnels, white with a black band circling the top, and 3 masts. Though the company's steamers were large, they were neither as luxurious nor as fast as the Cunard or White Star liners. A national ship took a fortnight to reach New York from London, whereas rivals could make the crossing in 6 or 7 days. By 1895 the company had abandoned the passenger trade and converted all of its ships to carry cattle. It was cheaper to transport live animals than to slaughter them first and keep the meat chilled on the crossing. As a chief steward, Coombs drew on his experience as a butcher and a greengrocer. He bought the provisions for a voyage before setting sail, and was in charge of the stores and the kitchen while at sea. Each crew member was apportioned rations of coffee, tea, water, sugar, bread, beef, pork, and peas. They were prepared and served under Coombs's supervision by a baker, a butcher, 1 or 2 cooks, and a couple of assistant stewards. On a passenger liner, the steward could be a grand figure with dozens of staff, like the manager of a large hotel. On the cattle ships he had a lowlier role. The sailors tended to look down on him and his men as flunkies. Coombs was paid a basic £7 for each 5 or 6 week round trip, which was supplemented by about £2 in tips and overtime. This was considerably more than most of the seamen, who received £4 per trip, though less than the master, the engineers, and the ship's mates. He undertook about 7 voyages a year, giving him a total salary of more than £60. According to a measure of affluence devised by Charles Booth in his massive survey, Inquiry into Life and Labour in London, 1886 to 1903, this placed Coombs above the poverty line in category E, fairly comfortable. He and his wife aspired to the respectable, relatively well-to-do life to which they had been raised, with good clothes for church-going, musical instruments for the children, literary magazines, an exotic bird in a cage, but they did not own property and employ servants, as their parents had done. Their income was stretched to the limit. When Coombs was at sea, Emily sometimes wrote to ask him to send home extra funds, and she occasionally pawned their possessions. The family's gold and silver watches, bracelets and rings were symbols of status, but also insurance against an uncertain future, objects that could be easily pledged or sold. Because he was a bankrupt, Coombs could not build up his own business, as his father had done, and his job was not secure. A ship's crew was discharged after each voyage, and although he so far had been regularly re-employed by the company, there was no guarantee of work. The national line was barely in profit. The market for American beef was declining, and the company's difficulties had been exacerbated by the loss of two uninsured ships in 1889 and 1890. Five further ships were scrapped or abandoned in 1894 and early 1895, leaving just six in the fleet. There was talk of winding up the company altogether, or at least selling off the rest of the older vessels, which included both the England and the France. On 20 July, the day of Emily Coombs's burial, the France was approaching the lighthouse at Sandy Hook, a spit of land near New York, at which the Atlantic steamers were met by the pilot boats that would guide them into the harbour. George Waldy, the captain of one of the Sandy Hook pilot boats, was sent to deliver the news of Emily's murder to her husband. Waldy, 48, had emigrated to America from Scotland as a young man. On Saturday afternoon, he took out Pilot Boat 13 to meet the France. He drew alongside and boarded, bearing a newspaper that carried a report of the murder in Plaistow. He delivered the paper to the ship's captain, who called Coombs into his cabin and handed it to him. Captain Hadley reported that Coombs read the account of his wife's death and his son's arrest in a dazed sort of way, and was afterwards unable to speak. He was prostrated with grief and horror. When the France sailed into the National Line's berth on Pier 39 of the North River at noon the next day, a friend of Coombs boarded the ship and handed him a cable from one of his relatives that urged him to return immediately to London. The friend invited him to stay with him first at his home in Newark, New Jersey, which lay 10 miles west of the North River piers. Coombs agreed. Before he left the France, though, he gave interviews to several newspaper men. Coombs looked pale and bewildered. "He described, in a mechanical way," said the man from the New York Times, "what he knew of the characteristics of his inhuman offspring, Robert." "I knew the boy was queer," he said, "but I never dreamed of this. It is terrible, terrible. I loved my wife devotedly, and to think—" At this point, the journalist wrote, Coombs paused and looked straight into the mist gathering down the bay. "My elder boy had an abnormally developed brain," he continued. "I was so informed by my family physician, who told me that Robert must be carefully watched. There was always something peculiar about him. When Robert was very young, he began to act queerly. As he grew older, he showed unusual intelligence for one of his years. He was a phenomenon in some respects, and yet there were traits developed in him which indicated the existence of some mental failure. Local doctors could not diagnosticate his trouble. He was at times the embodiment of all that is lovable in a child, and then would come over him a spell that would frighten us. For instance, if he read of a ghastly murder, his whole mind would seem to be absorbed in it. Nothing could divert him from it. In these spells he would neglect the companionship of his playmates.
After the spell passed, he would be a child again, as innocent and unsophisticated as anyone of his age. One time there was a murder near London. A man called Reed had committed a brutal crime. The papers were filled with the particulars. My boy read about it and ran away from home. He travelled miles to get a look at the murderer. According to the diagnosis of several physicians whom I called into the case, the boy was afflicted with a preponderance of brain matter. They said he had too much brain tissue for the size of the skull, and that in consequence the brain matter was crushed in too tight a space, and that accounted for the boy's eccentricities, and also explained his periods of phenomenal mental brightness. I do not pretend to know what their theory was, but they told me that if he lived to be 14 years old, the brain trouble would disappear. But he did improve as the years went by, and I had come to believe that the doctors were right and that he would eventually be of sound mind. "He kissed me on the docks in London 2 weeks ago, Thursday," said Coombs. "And then to think he went back and killed his mother." Coombs was quick to clear Natty of any part in the crime, and eager to implicate John Fox. "The younger boy was not to blame," he said. "He acted entirely on the command of the older boy. He was only 11 years old, and if the older boy told him it was all right, he would believe it." Natty was, in fact, 12. "The half-witted man, John Fox, who is associated with the boys in this terrible crime, is responsible for it, I believe," said Coombs. "He was formerly employed on the national line of steamers, but had become so irresponsible that he was not permitted to go to sea again. He frequently loitered around my premises doing chores and running errands. Latterly I have forbidden him to come to my house."
Captain Hadley, who had been master of the France for more than 10 years, endorsed Coombs's suspicions. Fox, he told the New York Times reporter, used to sail with him, but had become so useless that he was not allowed to come on board the steamer. On one occasion he was found lurking in a dark gangway with a long knife, lying in wait for a shipmate against whom he bore a grudge. Captain Hadley said Fox was what he called a softy. The captain spoke highly of the Coombs boys, both of whom he said that he knew well. Mrs. Coombs, he said, had been particularly proud of the intelligence of her elder son. Hadley expressed his belief that Fox was to blame for the crime.